Welcome, welcome, welcome. How's everybody doing? Hope you are doing well. My name is Andrew Kuhn with Focus Compounding, on air live with Jeff Gannon. Jeff, how's it going today?
It's going very well, Andrew. How's it going with you?
It's going great. We hope it's going great with everybody else as well. If this is the first time you are tuning in with us, thank you so much for joining us. Be sure to check out all of our content that we push out into the investing universe. The best way to do that is to follow me on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Focused Compound. All the information can be found in the description below. If you want to get access to investment write-ups from Jeff going all the way back to 2005, go to focuscompounding.com and you can get access to that backlog all for free. We are doing a call for questions and topics and anything that you would want Jeff to write about or for us to talk about here on the podcast. So I'm going to put Jeff's email in the description below. So definitely feel free to utilize that and send him some questions that you have on investing, and we'll see if we could pull it for a blog post or for the podcast. Is there anything in particular that you want people to do? Is there anything in particular that will stand out to you, which could increase the likelihood that they would be featured in a post or on the podcast? Is there anything, any advice you would give, Jeff?
Yes. I mean, an open-ended question about an investing topic is a lot more likely that I'll be able to give a good answer to. Just a ticker symbol or something, especially if it's something I don't know anything about, is a lot less likely, you know. Sometimes things that are Googleable that you could just find the answer to, like a formula for something or whatever, is less likely. Like I said, something more open-ended, process things, whatever. How do you do this in a more general sense, or what's better or worse in a more general sense that can lead to a larger article, is usually better than something like a specific stock question, but it depends on the stock.
Yeah. So they shouldn't reach out to you and say, what's your view on Robinhood, for example, or Reddit, I imagine, because you're going to say, well, I haven't really studied the companies enough, or what?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. That can be a good question, but if it's just a question, what's your view on Robinhood, then no. But yeah. If it's, you know, well, here's what I think about them, and all my friends say that these things, and I wonder, you know, look at these. I thought that these were speculative whatever things, and they wouldn't do well, and then they did do well. What does this tell you? You know, if it's in a question that's more useful as a process thing, then yeah. So there's lots of, all those sorts of stocks can be useful examples of things. I'm not going to write anything about Reddit, but we talked about, you know, Reddit's almost a 20-year-old company or something. We talked a little bit about, you know, it didn't go public for so long, then it did go public. Then what happened with the meme things and the environment goes public in. So, you know, questions about meme stocks specifically, a meme stock wouldn't be good, but a question about, like, you know, how is it that it matters so much when they go public, and why do some attract attention and others don't, or whatever. You know, that's what I mean by a more open-ended question, that there's some thought that you're putting into the question that you're thinking about, and it's something you've thought about and you want to have some conversation on that, as opposed to like trying to look at the financials of those things. Obviously, you know, questions about stocks that have consistently lost money in the past, we don't really talk on the podcast about those. And it would be very rare for me to think of a situation where something had consistently lost money and yet looked interesting. It's possible. We did talk about Celsius. They had high gross profits, but had lost money because they hadn't scaled up enough. You know, it's not impossible. There are companies where it could be a situation where they lose money, but it looks like they're going to turn a corner. You know, but obviously a lot of stocks that we look at would be ones that make money in more years than not. I would, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Celsius, $20 billion market cap now.
Mm-hmm. So a question about Celsius is, you know, if someone had something about that, is something more general that could be applied to other stocks and things, is what we're looking for generally. And that's what I prefer to write about, obviously, is things that have a longer life and can be applied to other stocks afterwards. You don't mm-hmm. want something that, you know, I've been writing things for close to 20 years now. And, you know, generally anything about specific stocks is not that useful. That's 20 years old. But sometimes it is useful to think about different market environments and different stocks and what eventually happened with them. And so those same kind of ideas can be applied to later periods. But many of the stocks that were public then are private now, or have gone private and then public again. New companies are there. It's totally different, you know? So things that are more lasting are always preferred for topics.
Well, that's very funny you bring this up, because you don't know our topic for the podcast here today, but no. It's basically on this idea of companies that last a very long time. And I wanted to speak to you about Standard Oil specifically, and how the company itself, different forms, has basically lasted the test of time in a very challenging industry. Why is that, right? So I'm talking about Exxon, Marathon, Chevron, Shell, Pennzoil, which Pennzoil, I believe, is actually owned by Shell. But why has Standard Oil survived all these years in what is a very difficult industry? And I want to get your opinion on that. When we were at the Willow Oak event in Omaha, Shri asked, maybe this was 2022. I don't think it was last year, because I think I was the one emceeing it. I believe Shri had asked which industry has had like the worst returns over, I don't know, 100 years or something like that, 150 years. And he asked me, and I just said energy. And I believe it was energy was the answer to that. So just curious to hear your thoughts on like durability, investing in companies that last a very long time. Why do you think a company like Standard Oil today still exists in a very challenging industry? Whereas you could compare that to a company like Sears, which is still a very challenging industry, but doesn't really exist today. What do you think that is? And I have it here up on the screen. I just have Marathon, Exxon, Chevron, and Shell to look at returns. But these companies obviously are very, they've been around for a very long time. These were the descendants of Standard Oil in one form or another when it was broken
up. It's a good question. I mean, the reason retail things don't last that long is because it's too specific. To be a company that lasts for a really, really long time, you have to be very generic. Buffett's talked about this a little bit with buy a commodity, sell a brand. You know, that the thing is, it's actually not that people have some huge preference for the taste of Coca-Cola or Tabasco or certain kinds of bitters or whatever. It's that it's essentially a commodity, but it's not a pure commodity. So they're not doing something very specific that way, and it's very flexible over time, right? So that helps you out. Now, very, very old companies can get that way through not growing. So it is possible. There's way more moats than there are good businesses, good companies. Moats aren't that hard to find. Big moats are hard to find. So if a company is family controlled, pays out dividends, all those sorts of things, stays small, it can exist for a very long time, whereas it doesn't get caught up in things that would cause it not to be around for as long, obviously. So the basic services, right? So I can't actually see what's on this list right now, but it's usually, you know, banks and
I was going to ask, what do you think?
Companies,
so for,
and yeah,
for people listening, I have a list of the 100 oldest publicly traded companies, because I was just curious, and I was thinking beforehand, what are, you know, the vast majority of those companies probably, and as Jeff had just said,
John
Wiley's
on there,
probably
banks. Family. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it depends. I mean, I would also say John Wiley in reality. So it depends on how they do this list. Some of these are things that are using a name that I am not sure is genuinely the name of the company. But John Wiley is a good example. That's a family-controlled company that stayed in the same thing, publishing. It's changed a little bit of what it does, but it does technical publishing, which was sometimes for professional-type things and sometimes for technical academic-type things. Obviously, that became a big business. It was brand new, publishing in those areas a few hundred years ago, and has stayed a big business. Now, it's all computerized and stuff, whereas it was all print back then. They sold off some of the business to other companies that got, you know, things that they didn't need. But the key thing there, because it's also still a family-controlled company, it was a family business. They were dedicated to that one industry, didn't want to leave it. They also didn't have a lot of descendants, which helps a lot. So, you know, if you see any lines of kings and things, it's really helpful not to have 10 kids or something ever. You don't want to do that, because then you get in a lot of trouble. But if everyone can make sure they just have one male heir, then it can work out fine.
Who was the company that you told me where they specifically attributed that to? Oh, John Wiley. Okay, so it was John Wiley you were speaking about. Okay.
That, yeah.
Can you explain that? Because you've talked about off air before that they've
because if it didn't, you see what happened. Dow Jones sold out, right? So like that was sold out. Wall Street Journal and stuff was sold out to Murdoch, and the reason why is that the ownership got too widely distributed by people who aren't operators at the company. So people who no longer had jobs at the company ended up owning a lot of the stock over time. Happens with lots of companies. Happens a lot sooner sometimes than that. And so within 100 years of some company being founded, a lot of the people who end up with stock as family members aren't actually involved with running the company or anything. So eventually they sell out to someone, it gets merged into something, you know, whatever. Whereas if it's a small number of people who are both owners and have some role in the company, their name is on the company, whatever, then you have a better chance of lasting for a long time, obviously. I also think that certain things, publishing is one example, do sometimes attract at least some people from a family or a culture or whatever to want to stick to that business and see that differently than spreading out into other things. But that's not always the case. In lots of cases, there's early generations are really have a sense of purpose and stuff around their product, and then later ones don't. You can see that with what happened with Anheuser-Busch, what happened with the Brofman family. There's other examples and stuff where there's a shift in terms of being willing to go into other things that probably the people who created the company wouldn't have been as interested in. Because they no longer saw the, you know, they didn't really care about the original product that they were in. But publishing tends to be more that people stick purely to that thing. Same with banking or whatever. But of course, not always. I mean, sometimes you have people come into companies, you know, people know the corporate history of like Vivendi or whatever. You take it from something that is in one business, a very old business, and then you move out into a lot of hot new things and, you know, taking a totally different direction. So it depends on who you bring in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As for Standard Oil, I guess the answer would probably be because of there's still demand for oil and their product here today.
Yeah, but one thing that is interesting, right, is you talked about energy. There's a very, very long-lasting thing around oil, mm-hmm. but there is not around coal. Mm-hmm. The coal company's gone bankrupt many times, been merged into things, all that. Oil is slightly technical and much more political of getting the reserves. It is a pure commodity otherwise, but it had seemed to be a better business than coal. Although once it became really easy to do fracking on a big scale for oil-rich things in the United States, I'm not sure we'll see the same longevity of companies that we did before. There are other examples from around the same era and stuff, comparing with like Standard Oil, companies, all the companies that make giant boilers for coal things, nuclear things, all thermal plants are really descendants of a few companies that were the founders that had the earliest patents on it and everything. The same thing with certain telephone things and stuff too, that actually you can trace them back to being all around telephone, radio, all around a few key things, and then they broke out of that. So having some sort of important skill that they had. Oil is interesting because most of the countries around the world, except for a few that were the first oil discoveries were, basically had their reserves developed by someone coming in who had technical knowledge from an already richer, usually, oil-producing country. And then eventually they either highly taxed them or they seized the assets or they kicked them out or nationalized or whatever, but they actually never had those abilities on their own. So they always brought someone in to develop it. And there's almost no examples I can think of where that didn't happen, and very few examples where they didn't then seize some of it from them, and yet the company still did okay. So in some way it was providing, it's a technology thing, where you want to call it that, or a skill, a process that they can carry out as a corporation, capital to do it, combined with something, like you said, that has this demand forever, right? Because there are other things that have had constant demand that have terrible histories. Coal, a lot of shipping things fall in the same category. It's not like it's ever slowed down the demand for those things. But you'd think coal and oil, the time periods are pretty similar in terms of when they were developed. And the longevity had been the same, certainly at least to the 1990 or so. But coal companies didn't have the same longevity as the big oil companies. And coal companies rarely achieve the scale of the big oil companies.
So why do you think that is? I mean, you and Ed said that you think coal's less political as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the skills probably of what was important in being a big oil company were different than coal. I do think that. And I do think that as it became more important politically in a variety of different ways, to secure things, same with gambling, I think that it does create monopolies and longevity in things where it's important to have those sorts of skills on a big scale, as opposed to like coal stuff, which I think is too easy in much of the world. Mm-hmm. But I mean, not necessarily all of it. You know, there's always little economic things like that that are quirks that it's hard to say. Liquor, alcohol is a good example. The economies of scale are at different levels. So I don't think it'll ever be as good to be a wine business because you can make a profit, you know, on wine fairly early. But operating more and more giant wineries isn't very helpful. Beer, it is more helpful. Spirits, it's super, super helpful. The economies of scale are huge. So a spirit company lasting forever on a really big scale makes sense. Wine companies can last for a really long time, but they're basically going to be in the same place that they owned many years ago, operating the same small scale. So I'm sure there's a champagne house or something that's been around a few hundred years that's owned by the same family. But it's probably working not that many different acres than it was back then, not producing that many more cases than it was then. Whereas the spirit company founded in the same time might be one of the biggest companies in the world, you know?
Is that a pricing thing? Why is that?
Well, I'd say...
Like, why do you think a spirits business could have better economics than a wine business? Because that's true. I mean, and even microcap land, we've come across vineyards and wineries and things that have exposure to wine, and they're just generally pretty horrible businesses. It's more of a trophy asset than anything, I feel like.
I mean, I think a small wine business is not worse than a small spirit business. I just think that they're natural economies of scale and spirits that are much, much bigger than there is with wine. You know, people think that there are economies of scale with marketing and stuff with wine, and maybe there are, but there's a bunch of problems. I mean, one is the degree of, so there's a much higher degree historically in wine to be able to differentiate yourself versus others, which is somewhat harmful. Like I said, like what you want is Coca-Cola or Tabasco or something where you're the standard, where you're preferred, or take ketchup, Heinz or something. You're generally preferred, but also you're seen as the standard thing versus someone who can come in and compete with you by saying that actually ours is spicier, ours is this, ours is that, ours is whatever. Wine for a long time has tried to compete in a variety of different ways besides the positioning of the product. So actually saying that it's in a different sort of category based on location, based on type of grape, based on all sorts of different things, besides just in spirit things, often your competition is basically product positioning, some psychographic stuff, and price. And so I'd say it's a big problem. It's almost like the problem that you see with men's watches and stuff versus women's watches, where the men's watch stuff is much more durable over time. Women's watches less so. The women's watches tend to be cheaper, more fashion oriented, turning over more, competing on a variety of different things. The men's watches compete on a much more limited thing, which is based a lot on positioning of the product. So the brand name, in strong association with the price. And so there's much greater durability, but a lot of men's products have much greater durability than women's products.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What about like national cash register, right? So mm-hmm. An industry that currently is undergoing a bunch of change, it seems like,
yeah.
But they've been able to iterate and adapt and still, you know, sure. Stay in the game. Coca-Cola, right? Obviously it's a very old company, yep. But they're still in the game. So is it like the first mover and then you get that brand awareness and then along the lines you're able to acquire and just do other stuff to still stay in the game? I mean, these are industries that have undergone, more so like NCR, tremendous change. And probably at this point in history with crypto and AI and all this stuff, it's probably going to continue to go under a bunch of change. So I'm just curious, you know?
It depends on what the change is and whether it really affects the economics, right? So it's not usually first mover. I mean, John Wiley, who said is 200 some years old and stuff, is not the first to do a lot of things.
Yeah.
Disney now is a little over 100 years old since the company that Disney's history is longer, but the company's own history is basically 100 years old. And not a first mover. But a lot of them did have a lot of success really early on. That is the luck part of it, or coming in at the right time or whatever. There is a brief period in which you can come in and have a lot of success, and then everything after that is based on that. So, you couldn't have... it would be hard for John Wiley to have the same history if it got in 50 years later. Disney couldn't come in 20 years later, so you couldn't be 20 years earlier or 20 years later. There was a certain period of time where there was a lot of change possible, like we said. But it's kind of like we talked about with car things. It's really the settling of the standardization, the prototypes of like what exactly will become the thing that everyone will adopt and will become the standard in the industry. So it's important to be involved in setting the standards for the industry. I agree with that. I don't know if that's a first mover thing. So like, Google's a search engine. I don't know if it's a first mover thing. A lot of the social media things, I don't know that they're first movers. However, what they do has become standardized and integrated into other things so that now when you look at it, it seems more like a first mover, some of these things, than they were, because it is what you think of when you think of that service, not realizing that it could have developed in a totally different way. So I think it's important to be early in that sense. Yeah. But I don't think a lot of them are actually what we call first movers or even close to it usually.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them have service revenue over time and have recurring revenue over things, like we said. So the engineering ones that they have are elevator companies, boilers, things like that. Those are very important safety things. And they have maintenance and long lives. That obviously helps. A lot of them are also things that don't lose money in a normal year. Some are somewhat cyclical, but a lot of the others aren't. So a bank's a good example. A bank will make money every year of its existence until it goes out of business. Because something horrible happens. Another one is obviously simply that it's the survivor bias of a huge number of companies in the beginning. And I shouldn't say bias, someone will survive. But, so let's say maybe 90 years ago, let's say a little more than that, 90 to 100 years ago, maybe the United States had 20,000 banks or something. And then, I don't know if it was 20,000 or 15,000 or something, but it was probably cut in half within a short period of time on a net basis, within 10 years or something. And yet it's never had more than what it was cut down to since then. It's kept going down over time, but it was just so many more, and on a basis per person, everything. So of course, if we weren't looking at publicly traded companies, just any companies, hotels, bars, restaurants, there are ones in the United States even, and certainly in other countries, that have been around a couple hundred years. But remember, there were in a big city, there were 2,000 examples of that, and there's, two left or something, over those hundreds of years. Just having so many does mean you're more likely to end up with some surviving that long. Mm-hmm. What do you notice about the list?
Lots of banks, lots of financials, see a bunch of insurance companies, lots of brands that we know and see every day, Altria, cigarettes, Cigna. I wasn't surprised to see a lot of these companies. This list says the oldest company was founded in 1715, GSK PLC, which I had in here, and it says it's a pharmaceutical company. You see Pfizer's on here, Procter & Gamble's on here as well. These are just a lot of the dominant brands that have been around. I think a lot of these companies, obviously, their form that they exist in today is probably similar, but I think acquiring other businesses and doing a bunch of things like that, they've had to pivot and adapt over time to continue to exist. But most of what they're doing is very similar.
Yeah, it is also interesting the importance of distribution stuff in a lot of them. I'd say it's a dominant part of many of them, which is hard to see because even the commodity ones that you notice on there, and this is also what we're talking about with oil, it's a little more debatable because I don't know that the oil companies are really production companies purely is why they existed for a long period of time. I think that the ability to distribute in the countries that they were working in is an important part of it. Certainly that's true for the drug companies big time. And many of the commodity ones that we're seeing here are actually largely commodity in terms of commodity trading, sourcing products from one part of the world to selling in another and everything, and not commodity producers. These aren't companies that own a lot of farmland or something. These are companies that trade grain between places or something in that industry, right? And like, yeah, a lot of the industrial ones do have very big maintenance components with a long-lived asset that has some sort of safety and also screwing up your operations and stuff if it goes wrong sorts of aspects to it, right? So like we said, we have things like boilers and elevators and stuff are the things you're seeing a lot of. Some are even more complicated, like the tractor ones. That incorporates everything, right? Deere is like all that stuff. It's distribution, it's financing, it's right out over a long area. It's the engineering things that we talked about with the maintenance things. It's like a perfect example of a company that could last forever.
Mm-hmm. A good way to find an industry that is durable and at least will be around for the next 10 to 15 years is probably find companies in industry that have been around for the past 100 years or a couple hundred years in this case. So I just thought it was interesting. There's one retailer and that looks like Macy's. I haven't seen another retailer on this list. Macy's, 1830.
That is shocking, right? Yeah. None of the retailers last, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But there are some brands that have been around for a very long time, like clothing brands. Like, so we were talking about like fashion and whatever, how that is cyclical or comes and goes. Levi Strauss has been around for a very long time. I saw this on that list. Vivendi. I mean, those are fashion related things, right?
Yeah. So Levi Strauss, like we said, was instrumental in setting certain fashion things that then lasted for a long period of time, obviously. So they were involved in the early days of denim stuff. But again, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be a first mover or something and last a really long time. I guess they're similar to like Smith & Wesson, which is also still around. And so I would put Levi Strauss in the same sort of category as a period of time in which there was a surge in sales of that kind of product to the public. There hadn't been very affordable guns and stuff before Smith & Wesson that the general public could buy a ton of because manufacturing methods change and stuff. And same sort of thing when you're talking about jeans and stuff with Levi. So some of them obviously changed what they were in. We talked about American Express. We talked about National Cash Register, but American Express is another good example. Some of them are completely different industries today and not too big. A lot of these are very big companies, but you see that just by lasting a long time, you eventually can acquire other things, build up retained earnings. And so just being profitable for a long period of time causes that. But we do have a bunch of publishers on here. One that I noticed was, let's see, what do we have there?
Dun & Bradstreet.
There are some that were in other businesses that make sense for a long time, and then they're in more recent businesses that don't. Is Matthews International on there? Matthews, that's a smaller company. Yeah, yeah. So that's like a, I don't know if it's not a small cap anymore, but maybe a mid cap or something like that. What do you know? So its actual business is memorialization, right? So so it talks about it there, but for death care things and stuff, right? So bronze and working in that and all that. That was originally what it was in, and I'm sure that's what its very long longevity is from. It then eventually turned into a very growthy type company, I don't know, 20 years ago or something, acquired a bunch of things, really changed, and I think the quality of the earnings and stuff declined a lot. But I think it's going to unload some of those things and may continue to exist again as a company that's in the same businesses. But that original thing that they were in, that core, would last for a really long time.
Interesting, because people keep dying and always will.
Well, if you go through a lot of these companies, you know that they diversified into other things that were the future, and then they got out of them and they're in the thing that they were in originally.
Why does that happen always? It seems like diversification, right? Is it because these companies get too much cash and they don't have abilities to reinvest in their core business? So investment bankers and people come to them and say, oh, you should acquire this, you should diversify, you should do this. Why is that?
I mean, yeah, it's also that the future is always more exciting that way. And you can grow faster. I mean, there's countless examples, if you look through the corporate history of some of those companies, of it's very common for a more durable company to buy a less durable company and then eventually exit and everything, but to do that kind of thing. So like you had cereal companies on there, for instance, some of them diversified into toys and other things like that, and then eventually sold those out. But that was part of it. Some of the publishing things acquired all sorts of different entertainment things and then got rid of them. Let's see what else you have there. Yeah, I mean, some of them have acquired all sorts of stuff, but their core is still what matters. So you have New York Times Company on there, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, New York Times, I think New York Times may have directly bought some forest product stuff, like actual land. If they didn't, another newspaper one did. They certainly bought, I think, about.com, right, in the early days of the internet there. And yet their key product throughout their whole corporate history is the same as it is now. I mean, they have some more sales in like games and things like that now, I guess, than they used to. That's a more important part of it. So what the product is has shifted and it's delivered online. But it's the same thing that it was before, and so there's not much of a difference, you know? It's subscriptions and advertisements in the New York Times Company. It's product of the New York Times, which is a daily product just like it was then, and it has some shift in how people use it, but otherwise it's pretty similar.
Not seeing too many energy companies on here.
No, you have a lot of the same industries repeated lots and lots of times. And it's interesting, even with something like Macy's or something, obviously it's a department store. Now, Macy's, I guess, wasn't that early in the department. Well, it was pretty early in the department store period. No, Macy's was for the United States. It was very early. So, again, that was a thing that happened, and quickly a bunch of department stores developed in different cities, and then they went there from local to national. A couple of these started out very local, became dominant, and then spread out. I guess the key thing is they were there and a leader at the moment when the industry went national, sort of like we're saying with the cereal things and Procter & Gamble, so they could do the national advertising and everything. There are lots of other companies that were successful in other cities around the country, but they were the ones who became big through the media of that happening at that time. Even New York Times or something, that's true. They were a leading paper and a leading city when that became a more national business. Same idea. And then you have very weird examples of things that pivoted completely. So it has Berkshire Hathaway there, for instance. Total pivot to an entirely different thing. Those are almost unheard of that kind of thing, where there's nothing to the core left anymore.
Literally nothing.
Yeah. I mean, I guess some things like American Express and stuff you could say have done that, depending on how you define it. But it's not all that different.
Luxottica.
And it lasted for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was Luxottica the company you're telling me about? It was a father, and then his son was at the company, mm-hmm. and he left. That was Luxottica? So you kind of talk about...
Yeah, Essilor Luxottica was merged with another company that had been public for a much longer time, which is a lens company, basically. Luxottica is a frame company. I'm simplifying, but that's basically the truth. And Luxottica, Italian company, Essilor, French company. And... yeah, Del Vecchio was the head of the company, and yeah, his son was a CEO at other public companies, actually. He came from Luxottica, but he did not end up running Luxottica. Yeah, he ran the U.S. operations for Luxottica at one time, and then from there he worked for a couple U.S. companies. At one time, I don't remember if under private equity or something, he was running Brooks Brothers at one point, but something in that neighborhood of those sorts of things, similar to the Luxottica stuff. Very, very similar to what he would have done if he had been at Luxottica. But, you know, there maybe wasn't great succession planning there. People didn't get along and everything. So, yeah, they had an excellent in the family. They had someone who was excellent as an executive who they were not able to turn the company over to. And eventually the company was merged with another company near the end of the founder's life. And so that's why it ends up with those two combined companies, both very old companies. Yeah. Luxottica is the much more recent one, though. The one that they're saying is the longer-term one is the one that acquired Luxottica, because Luxottica was essentially founded only in one person's lifetime, you know. Mm-hmm. The factories that he bought and stuff might have predated that. So, but yeah. Yeah, and that obviously it's very, very industry dependent, right? So it depends a lot on being in the same industries. And that seems to be much more important than being a great company, which does, I think, is true and raises some serious questions about, you know, leadership books and all of those sorts of things, which are supposed to apply to all sorts of things, business books. Should a business book really tell you, look, if you're a retailer, don't think about multi-generational wealth and stuff. You can't be done. You can build something up, sell the concept to someone, take the money and do something else with it. And you could do that a couple times or something, but should they just teach how to be an entrepreneur to get a system going with a retailer that you can then sell out to someone else and move on, instead of actually telling people that you can build something that your grandkids could inherit? Because obviously, you know, it doesn't happen very often in retail. And maybe some of that is the operator risk, because once you lose someone, then do you have a huge drop off? You need to have a business that you don't need to run for it to be durable. People can't be that important in a business. Top leadership can't be that important, because obviously over 100 years, 200 years, you're going to have a lot of bad people in the executive office at some point. So that can't be a very important part of what makes your business successful.
That's like the Buffett quote, right? Find a company that's so great that any idiot can run one or run it, because at one point there probably will be an idiot running it.
Yeah. And you see that, you know what, let's see, Geico and C's probably have a similar longevity and stuff, but you can see that Geico in the long run is much riskier than C's.
Way tougher.
But, you know, it doesn't have to be, but it's because of the risk of the people coming in there. I've said that with the financial things. I know I would never put money into a financial stock with the expectation that you can leave it there forever, because new people can come in and radically change it. So I would always be more comfortable with the wrong person running Disney than the wrong person running, JP Morgan or whatever. That would always be true, just because of what can go wrong. Yeah, but I mean, you do have some financial things that are very long life, but obviously they've been a big part of the economy for a very long time. You have to pick industries that you think the thing that they do is going to be important many years from now. For those that are in niches, it does seem like they're kind of the standard setter. It's not just that they're a very popular brand or something, but they're the standard thing you think of when you think of that product.
It's like Deere and Company. Mm-hmm. That's what I think when I think farming, right?
Right. And even when people say a competitor or something, or like a peer, what they'll put as a peer is like Cat, which isn't Cat, actually a competitor. Yeah. It's just the same thing in a different category. Right. And the same thing happens when we talk about Dun & Bradstreet. It would happen. Fair Isaac's a much younger company, but it would happen if we're talking Fair Isaac or any of those sorts of things. There's someone in which I can't even really find a comparable. Like I said, in there is some competition in bitters, and there was before Tabasco. They were the standard setter in pepper sauce stuff. You know, yes, you can find competing products there, but people often confuse the product with the company's name. It's so much of a standard in that way. So you confuse credit score with FICO score. And yes, they pioneered it and stuff, but like then in all other industries, someone else comes along and you forget the pioneer. I mean, right, Oreo is the standard, not Hydrox, even though Hydrox was first. So in this case, a lot of times that would be the case. You think of something as like a Tabasco sauce or like the whatever other thing. It's a choice. It's an alternative, and you're aware of that. You would be aware today. We can think of what things might last a really long time, right? Google, any search that you use that's different from Google, you're comping against Google. You don't really have an idea of what's good and bad search. You just know what this is versus Google, because it's so your whole concept of searching for things has been formed now by Google. You know what I mean? So that's actually your conception of what search is, even though it could be all sorts of different things, right? So you kind of, it's the benchmark at least. That doesn't mean it'll last forever, but it means it has a much better chance than some other products.
Well said. Well said. Cool. Well, I want to thank everybody so much for tuning in with the both of us on the Focused Compounding Podcast. This is the first time you're joining us. Be sure to check out all of our content that we push out into the investing universe. If you're interested in learning about our money management services, you can reach out to me at andrew@focuscompounding.com, or go to our website, focuscompounding.com, and click that Invest With Us tab. I want to thank Gabby so much for all the support. Hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening or watching us here today. And we will see you in the next podcast. Take care.